A lot can happen in a week. Some of it good, some of it bad, some of it downright ugly. When faced with intriguing developments in the week's news, we turn to a rotating panel of non-experts to parse the good, the bad, and the ugly of it all. On today's panel, Raul Ramos, Associate Professor of History at the University of Houston, and Natalie Arsenault, President of Arsenault International Consulting. Raul, Natalie, welcome to Houston Matters.
Howdy.
Hi, Craig.
Panel, former Houstonian George Floyd was murdered 5 years ago Sunday by a white police officer in Minneapolis during an arrest. His death sparked nationwide outrage and protests. The next month, here in Houston, artists came together to create a mural dedicated to Floyd, a Third Ward childhood resident, along with references to fellow Houstonian Sandra Bland, who died in a Waller County jail 3 days after her arrest at a traffic stop, Breonna Taylor, a Louisville medical worker shot and killed during a botched police raid, and the Black Lives Matter movement that sprang up from these and other tragedies. This week, that mural in what became known as the Ennis Art Block at the corner of Elgin and Ennis in Third Ward was demolished. Resident Naomi Carrier tells KHOU she was ready to cry about the demolition, calling it a project of erasure. No word on what will go up next in the space left behind, though Carrier mused in a few years' time it could be a condo. The George Floyd Black Lives Matter mural in the Third Ward and the building it was on are demolished this week, which happens to be the fifth anniversary of Floyd's murder. Is this good, bad, or ugly? Natalie Arsenault.
I think it's probably a blend of all of them, because I probably have some unpopular opinions here. Obviously, I think it's good that there was even a mural up for the sake of remembering. I kind of want to know, was the building, like, could someone buy the building? Like, because if you just put a mural up on the side of the building and the building doesn't belong to you, then at any point in time, the owners or the city or state, whoever is owns the deed to that, can do whatever they want to do with it, which is ultimately what has happened here. I also have kind of have quite a strong reaction when we start talking about immortalizing people in statues, on public property, on sides of buildings and things like that, regardless of like the circumstances around that individual. My preference is for people to put those articles that are to memorialize instances and events in history that have happened that we should really pay attention to in museums. And so I would really prefer for it to be in a museum where you might have a little bit more control over what happens to the installation and that and so forth. I guess it was bad timing to do it the week of the fifth anniversary. Like, I feel like they could have been a little more sensitive to the timing around when they decided to demolish the building. They could have had an actual ceremony around it, being that since it was the week of the fifth anniversary of it happening, they could have done something along those lines to memorialize it, and share what they were looking to do in the future, the people who owned it or whatever. So I think it was bad timing to do it the week of the. It was very insensitive, I feel like. But I do think this is an opportunity now for those who want to memorialize that event or those events, actually, because it was bigger than just George Floyd, to look for a space where it can have a more permanent residency and exist without any challenges.
All right. Good, bad, or ugly? Raul Ramos.
Well, I agree. It's bad, and I would add tragic, to see this happen after a tragedy. And there's a way that the creation of the mural was organic. Like you said, Natalie, it was not an official space of any sort. Clearly, the owners of the building might not even live in Houston, as far as we know. I don't know any of that specific background. I do know Houston has some pretty weak historic preservation protections, in comparison to other cities around the country. This was commemorating not just a local person and an event that had an impact locally and nationally, I would say even globally. I mean, the moment that this happened, we're still undergoing that transformation. We're still coming to terms with what this means. It's reverberating in intended ways and unintended ways. That history is still 10, 15, 20 years from being written. So I think that it's about an organic expression of grief and an expression of community in particular. And this is the part that is also tragic, in the sense that we're looking for ways of representing our community, our neighbors, at a time when that feels unstable, it feels like it's changing. And the mural had provided that kind of anchor. I agree with you that not only was the timing bad, there are ways of preserving this, right? If this was maybe announced, you could have had a group come together, maybe even Project Row House, CDC could have put together at least an effort to preserve that wall. You don't have to preserve a whole building. You can preserve a wall. It happens all the time. We see it in all sorts of historical redevelopment that takes place in Houston. And I think Houston has some great models for that. We didn't have that opportunity. And again, those protections don't exist in Houston. Maybe there's a small fine they might have to pay if there was some kind of recognition, but I don't even think that that's there. I do think this is an opportunity, though, to think about making these kinds of permanent projections onto our community. I think murals are incredibly important. You know, in Mexican history, murals, particularly after the Mexican Revolution, play a very important role in creating a national identity. You have the murals by Orozco, Siqueiros, Diego Rivera. Those murals not only created a sense of community and a sense of belonging, but connected with the larger history of pre-colonial Mexico and through the various challenges, and depicted a phoenix surging out of those ashes. And I think that was the hope of this mural, that you see it, and it was full of hope out of tragedy, that we could change our society and our communities for the better.
Panel, a Harris County man is suing Whataburger for allegedly leaving onions on his hamburger. Demary Ardell Wilson seeking between $250,000 and $1 million in damages. He filed suit late last month after allegedly sustaining serious personal injuries following an allergic reaction last July to the onions in question, which he says he requested to be left off of his burger. Last Friday, Whataburger filed its response, arguing Wilson failed to use caution as would have been used by a reasonable person under the circumstances. This, by the way, is not Wilson's first such lawsuit. In May of last year, he filed one against Sonic for allegedly leaving onions on a burger there in April of 2023. As Houston Public Media's Kyle McClenaghan reported Monday, Sonic denied that allegation and that case is ongoing. A Houston man sues Whataburger because a store allegedly left onions on his hamburger. Is this good, bad, or ugly? Raul?
Well, there are so many ugly aspects to this story. And I will just say that we live in a time where we're very conscious and aware of what we're eating, what we're buying, what we're putting into our bodies. You know, I have several relatives who are gluten intolerant or have gluten allergies. And so that's particularly challenging. I've found out things that I didn't know. I didn't realize that soy sauce has wheat in it. And that's something that you don't learn until you're with somebody that has an allergy. So you're not only asking, please hold the bun on my burger, but please don't put any soy sauce on my teriyaki. And so that's part of the change that you, the awareness and the change that you need to bring to any kind of situation. So I kind of agree with Whataburger. I mean, it's not that hard to just open the bun and look. You're not talking about an ingredient that's mashed into the patty or anything like that. This is something that's very, I don't like mustard. I wipe the mustard off if it's on there, if they accidentally don't put it. And I understand this is not about a preference. My friend Brad can't stand onions, can't stand eggs. Like, I get it. But this is an allergy. And so I understand. But at the same time, this is something that can be changed. These allergies have changed the world around us. Used to be that you got peanuts on an airplane, right? They don't serve peanuts anymore. I think maybe Delta might still, but they took peanuts off the airplanes for peanut allergies, for people who have very extreme reactions to peanuts around them. So I think we have an increased sensitivity to that. I think the world has developed an increased sensitivity to that. You sit down at a restaurant now, and the first thing they ask you is, are there any allergies we should be aware of? I appreciate that. And I think that starts a conversation that educates everyone around us.
Well, you've certainly given a lot more thought to this than I have. And I'm afraid to say we're out of time. Sorry, Natalie. No. Good, bad, or ugly, Natalie Arsenault.
I don't know. So as a person who has allergies and actually has an EpiPen, I am inclined to agree with Whataburger. I'm like, you, the only person who can save you is you. I'm convinced of that. So I don't depend on anybody else to hopefully get it right. And all of a sudden, like, I'm like, look, I could die from this. I need to do all the checks to make sure. So it's not that with an onion type of allergy. I mean, like, he could have just opened the bun, which I certainly would have done. I would have told them, yes, about the allergy. But then I also would have double checked, because you're dealing probably with teenagers and people who aren't paying attention and all sorts of things in the fast food industry. It seems like he has a bit of a pattern here. And I also know, like, I, for example, we're getting ready to go to Louisiana, and you go to New Orleans, and one of my allergies is actually seafood and shellfish. So I don't eat anything, because literally one time I was there, I was getting green beans. I told the waiter my allergies. I was like, hey, look, seafood, shellfish, pork, I will die. Please don't kill me. And I get these green beans and I take a bite. And I was like, this green bean tastes kind of fishy. I was like, what is the thing? And he was like, oh, yeah, we put anchovy sauce in our. I was like, oh, my God. And at that time, my lips started to swell up the side of my face. And I didn't have an EpiPen. So my mom is crushing up Benadryl. I'm practically snorting Benadryl like a heroin addict of some sort. It's really important. So I it's important to emphasize it. Yes. But it's also important to double check. And just make sure two or three times into the process, because, again, I firmly believe no one can save you but yourself. So that's important. So I'm with Whataburger on this. Like, you know, and don't eat at places where they, like, if I had an onion allergy, I probably would not be going through a drive-through. I guarantee you. Now, maybe I would go to a burger place where they make, like, I can watch them make the burger and all of that. But I wouldn't. I really wouldn't. You also have to be very cautious, and you're the only person who can own that responsibility, is you being very cautious. So hopefully the legal system prevails, and, you know, Whataburger isn't forced to pay, and Sonic isn't forced to pay for something that, you know, you also have your own responsibility for. So that's my hope.
But did you sue the restaurant for $250,000? That's the question.
I should have. No. I mean, I was a missed opportunity. Dang it.
You were on your Benadryl high at that moment. You couldn't really think straight.
I was.
Panel, Sesame Street's future received some clarity this week with the announcement that Sesame Workshop had reached a streaming rights deal with Netflix that not only keeps the show available over the air for free on public television, but allows public TV stations to air new episodes at the same time they become available for streaming on Netflix and PBS Kids. This is a much more favorable deal for public television than the prior agreement the makers of Sesame Street previously had with HBO Max, which for the last decade had exclusive rights to new episodes for months before they were made available to PBS stations. Sesame Street debuted and aired exclusively on PBS for its first 45 years. As NPR's Elizabeth Blair reported Monday, its next season, its 56th on television, will feature the return of the fan favorite segments Elmo's World and Cookie Monster's Foodie Truck. Sunny days again for Sesame Street, which will continue to be available for free over the air on public television while also streaming on Netflix and PBS Kids. Is this good, bad, or ugly? Natalie.
It's great. I love it. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Sesame Street and a lot of the shows that are on PBS bring a lot of education. They open thoughts. They share different perspectives. I remember, like, the Mr. Rogers episode where, you know, during kind of that civil rights period, he put his feet in the pool with, you know, the mailman who was black and all that. Like, there's so much learning to be had from a lot of these shows. And it's put into a genre that is palatable and easy to comprehend for young minds to begin to process and think about it and consider, you know, the options and impacts and all that. So anytime these types of shows can continue on and also be free is great, because, you know, one of the things I think we assume is that everybody has access to everything, and it's not true. So not everybody is paying for cable or paying for all the streaming services or paying for all, you know, just whatever. So anytime you can get it and it's no charge and it's an educational opportunity, I think it's fantastic. So I'm super excited about this.
All right, Raul.
It's so good. It's like a warm hug that they're continuing the show, that it's not falling victim to the cuts we're seeing all around us all the time. I mean, this is one of the hopes we have for our world, really, that the lessons, I agree, Nellie, are the education you're getting is content, of course, you know, every letter of the alphabet you learn through Sesame Street, but it's also emotional learning. You get that modeling, community modeling ways of dealing with difficult things. I don't know if you knew, in 2017, Sesame Workshop received a $100 million grant to develop programming for kids in Syria who had war trauma. I mean, that's how powerful these Muppets are, and the ability to think about a future and a world that is welcoming, that is supportive. I kind of sometimes feel like you're a Muppet, Craig. I listen to you, and I feel like you bring a little bit of Sesame Street to us here in Houston every day. You're our own, I don't know, people don't see, but I feel like you're some character.
What gives you that impression, Raul? Why would you say that?
Today's Good, Bad, and Ugly is sponsored by the letter U for ugly. It's...
Raul Ramos is an associate professor of history at the University of Houston. Natalie Arsenault is president of Arsenault International Consulting. Raul, Natalie, thanks very much.
Thanks
Greg. Sunny day.